got a letter from Maria. It says, I've been a social worker therapist for over 20 years now. I moved to a new city 2 years ago with the specific goal of working for a prestigious mental health provider located here. I was hired there for the second time. I turned down a previous offer 6 months ago. It's a great, if challenging, job. Every single day, I feel like an imposter. I hope it will get better, but I'm not holding my breath. Larry writes, I'm the poster boy for imposter syndrome, or I could be if I believed I'd look good on the poster. I started my semi-adult life as a theater student where I didn't audition for shows I wanted to be in because I couldn't imagine why anyone would cast me. Then I went to law school where I was convinced I was the least qualified, least capable student there because everybody else seemed to have a passion for it while I was just trying not to starve. After graduation, I tried private practice with a boutique firm in Los Angeles briefly, but retreated to work as an appellate court clerk after finding that wearing a suit and tie made me feel like I was still a theater student playing dress-up surrounded by real lawyers. But at least I was trained for that career. After a decade in law, I made a midlife shift to software engineering, which I've done more or less successfully for 25 years, despite waking up every morning believing that everyone around me with their computer science degrees knew more than I ever could or would. I'm almost at retirement age, and I've never held a job or been in a relationship where I felt like I wasn't constantly being judged a fraud. This week's episode is about imposter syndrome. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. And imposter syndrome, you can spell imposter with an O-R or an E-R, both ways are correct. It exists in kind of an in-between place. It's not a mental disorder, at least according to authorities on such things, but it is a mental phenomenon that can really screw with you, make life more difficult. It can make it harder, or it can make it impossible to enjoy where you are in life. It's your harshest critic, and the calls are coming from inside the house. So it bears some examination. Dr. Valerie Young is the co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute and the author of the book The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women, Why Capable People Suffer from Imposter Syndrome, and How to Thrive in Spite of It. Dr. Valerie Young, welcome to Depression Mode.
I am thrilled to be here, John.
What is your definition of imposter syndrome?
Imposter syndrome is this belief that deep down we're really not as intelligent, capable, competent, qualified as other people seem to think we are. And what is so fascinating about that, John, is we have these beliefs despite concrete evidence of our accomplishments or our abilities. And as a result, there is this fear that we are going to be found out.
And how common is this? Because it seems to have struck most people I know, and the ones who it hasn't struck, I get a little suspicious of.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the research that you look at. The statistic that's often tossed around is, you know, 70%. You know, I've seen some research in some fields and at certain levels in organizations as high as 82%. So it is very common. The thing is, not everyone experiences it to the same degree. There really is considered kind of, you know, low grade, kind of moderate or intense feelings of imposter syndrome. So in that regard, fewer people feel it intensely, but it's more problematic the more intense you do feel it.
Now, imposter syndrome is not in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Should it be?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. It is not, nor has it ever been considered a diagnosable mental health condition of any sort. The original term, John, is imposter phenomenon. Mm. Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes, who are two clinical psychologists at the time working at Georgia State University, first coined the term imposter phenomenon. And really, it's pretty clear in the world of psychology that it is not a quote-unquote syndrome in the way that is defined in the field of psychology. I will tell you that I continue to use the term imposter syndrome much to the disappointment of many in psychology. And the reason I do is I make the point, John, that I actually did a search with the Library of Congress. Their reference librarians went back and looked at when did it morph into being called imposter syndrome? Because that's really how, in the popular culture, that's how it's pretty much known. Clance and I coined imposter phenomenon in 1978. As early as 83, it could have been earlier because not a lot of things are digitized back then. It began morphing into to syndrome. And I think the disconnect is when you're in psychology or you're an academic, your source of reference is the DSM. For the rest of us, the majority of us, our source of reference is the dictionary. And the dictionary offers, as the second definition of syndrome, a set of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that constitute a pattern. That's how I use syndrome, because that aptly describes imposter syndrome, imposter phenomenon.
In recent years, it's become more common for people to describe imposter syndrome as not being a real thing and suggest that it's a way to place the burden on individuals who are dealing with systemic oppression. Like it's the system and it's being treated as an individual phenomenon. What's your take on that stance?
Here's where I completely agree. I don't think we should be looking at imposter syndrome solely through this individual lens, right? We didn't grow up in a vacuum. We don't exist in a vacuum. So I think we absolutely have to consider it in the context of whenever you belong to any group for whom there are stereotypes about competence or intelligence, that group is going to be more susceptible. That could be women, that could be people of color, that could be folks with disabilities or who are doing business or going to school in a language that is not their own language. You know, people who are so-called first generation professional students more likely to have imposter feelings. So absolutely, if you're in a field or an environment where there's not a lot of people with disabilities, for example, or you're the first indigenous person to hold, you know, the senior role. So the first, the few, or the only, they are absolutely right. You're going to be more susceptible to imposter syndrome. But I reject this notion that stop talking about individuals and only focus on systems, because there's other sources of imposter syndrome that are maybe sometimes overlapping, but separate from the societal ones. In other words, people in certain occupations are more vulnerable. People in creative fields, writing, acting, singing, where you're being judged by subjective standards, by people whose job title is professional critic. People in highly information-dense, rapidly changing fields like science, technology, medicine, also more susceptible. And there's certain organizational cultures that fuel self-doubt. One of them is academia. And, you know, imposter syndrome is rampant at universities. And I don't just mean just among students, but also faculty and staff. A lot having to do with being in a culture of critique. You're surrounded by very highly educated people. Similarly, in medicine, you know, when you're going to medical school, when you're a resident, it is a culture of shaming where students are shamed for not understanding things. And so you see a lot of it there as well. So there's other factors. I believe that if all those other factors went away tomorrow, you know, we somehow magically ended systemic bias and all those other things went away, but we kept our unrealistic, unsustainable expectations about what it means to be competent, which I think is the core driving source of imposter syndrome, then nothing would change. If we kept that, nothing would change.
What do people who really suffer on the more intense side of the scale from imposter syndrome have in common?
You know, again, I don't know what the research would say, but I'm going to guess a very strong perfectionist tendency so that they're never satisfied with their work. They believe they always not only could, but should have done better. I mean, we could all do better, right? But they're, I think, over-personalizing imposter syndrome. I'm an advocate of stepping back and recognizing that I think in many ways, imposter syndrome has been over-psychologized. That we need to understand kind of the perfectly good reasons why someone might feel like an imposter. So when we have a normal imposter moment, we can do less personalizing and more contextualizing. So, for example, I think I've worked with a lot of very major, huge global law firms. You see a lot of imposter syndrome in law firms, John, because it's highly competitive. Everyone's vying for these partnership positions. So imposter syndrome amongst associates is very, very high. You go to a big law firm and you went to, you know, a small law school or a state university and everyone went to Yale or Harvard. you know, you could start comparing yourself and judging yourself. I'd rather that that person step back, again, do more contextualizing. Well, yeah, sure, I didn't go to one of these big schools, and put that into context. Yep, I'm in a highly competitive environment, and just really focus on not perfectionism, but doing an excellent job, recognizing that striving for excellence is different than perfectionism, and that we're never going to know everything, which is the equivalent of trying to get to the end of the internet.
What can organizations and places of work do to help lessen the effects of imposter syndrome for the people who work there?
That's a great question, because I think to that point you brought up earlier around this emphasis on looking at systems, there are things that organizations can do to, for example, step back and say, are there ways that our culture reinforces self-doubt and imposter feelings? Do we kind of pit people against each other in a competitive way that maybe is not as comfortable for some people as it is for other people? There's three kind of core tools that what we recommend, John, for individuals, but organizations can use them as well. So one tool is, again, to normalize imposter syndrome. Bring it out of the closet, have a conversation about it. You know, as a manager, as a leader, to say, hey, has anybody heard of imposter syndrome? It's interesting. I'm learning about it. And to openly talk about times when they have had these feelings, that could be tremendously helpful. There was a company in their job postings, at the bottom of the job posting, it said, we recognize the confidence gap, they're talking about between men and women. We recognize the confidence gap and imposter syndrome are real. We want you to apply. Great example of normalizing it. Because somebody reading that who wasn't familiar with imposter would go look it up and maybe apply when they wouldn't have before, thinking they didn't know everything they needed to know. The second tool is to reframe. In other words, to understand that people who don't feel like imposters, and I'm not talking about that narcissistic, you know, the irrational self-confidence syndrome, you know, the person who really doesn't know what they're talking about, but people who are genuinely humble, but have never experienced imposter syndrome, they're no more intelligent, capable, competent, qualified than the rest of us. It's just in the exact same situation where we might feel like an imposter, they're thinking different thoughts. But it's not a pep talk. It's not like, you got this and you can do it and you deserve to be here. Because if all it took was a pep talk, there'd be no such thing as imposter syndrome. They think differently about three things. They have a realistic understanding of what it means to be competent. So they're much more self-forgiving of, you know, normal, again, off days, mispronouncing a word, forgetting their train of thought, not knowing 150%, realizing there's going to be a learning curve, those kinds of things. They have a healthy response to failure, mistakes, setbacks, and constructive feedback, which, let's face it, feels like criticism to us. And they understand that a certain amount of fear and self-doubt is part of the achievement journey. See, what I hear a lot is people think, the fact that I even feel like an imposter must mean I am one, because if I was an imposter, you know, I'd be confident all the time. And my response is, yeah, good luck with that, right? Feeling confident 24/7. No, you wouldn't. A certain amount of anxiety and fear that goes with the achievement journey of stepping into a new job, walking up to a podium.
So we've talked a little bit about what organizations can do. What should an individual do? What's the most successful way that you've found of addressing this if you're feeling these symptoms of this syndrome?
Yeah, well, truly, whether it's an individual or organization, it's going to come down to reframing. What is the messaging in the organization about what it means to be competent? Are people allowed to have an off day? How do people at a meeting process the fact that, yeah, this project didn't go very well? Helping individuals understand. I was just out in Denver the other day. I was speaking at the Federal Reserve of Kansas City, and one participant said, she was a leader, and she said, how can we give people feedback in a way that they hear, right? Because often if you say that report was inadequate, we hear, I'm inadequate. I said, I would step back first and on an organizational level, have a conversation about the value of feedback. I think sports analogies are useful here. Do you want to tennis coach that's going to say, well, John is holding his racket wrong, but I don't want to hurt his feelings, so I'm not going to say anything? Or do you want somebody who's going to give you, you know, honest feedback? What's the messaging in the company? I spoke at Facebook, and they had all kinds of posters on the wall because the employees can go make a poster anytime. They have a poster shop out at a headquarters. One of them stood out to me. It was an Ernest Hemingway quote, and it said, "The first draft of anything is shit." It's a very powerful cultural message that, you know, this is an organization who's looking at, let's just try it. It's not going to be perfect. The very successful entrepreneurs that I know, their mantra is half ass is better than no ass, right? Which they don't mean do a bad job, but they mean, you know, in an organization, you have to get version one out the door and you can course correct as you go along. There's going to be bugs. You know, the second time we do it is going to be better than the first, and the third is going to be better than the second. So I think that kind of messaging and reframing in organizations is really powerful.
Are people who experience this kind of thing, can they make peace with it? Is it a kind of thing where you can say, yes, this is just something I manage? Because that's true in mental health a lot. And I know that you're not a doctor in that category, but for people who deal with chronic anxiety, chronic depression, it can be like just an annoying passenger in the car that you learn how to put up with and you learn how to manage. Is this the kind of thing that can be cured and wiped away, or is this the kind of thing that people who deal with this will always be dealing with to some extent?
That's such a great question, John. And for many years, my answer would have been, you know, it may never go away. But I'm meeting more and more people who said, yeah, I really felt this way, but because they're changing how they think, their feelings changed. Hmm. You know, in other words, I know what people want. They come and hear me talk, or they read my book or a book on imposter syndrome. They want to start out feeling like an imposter and then walk out not feeling like an imposter. And that's not how it works, right? Feelings are the last to change. So for me, the only way to stop feeling like an imposter is to stop thinking like an imposter. To me, the quote unquote cure is to kind of have insight, tools, information. So when you have what I want them to understand is a normal imposter moment, to be able to talk themselves down off that imposter ledge more quickly. So instead of having this imposter life that they feel like I have to manage this, they can have an imposter moment, or maybe a 24-hour news cycle. But at that point, here's the key, is to at that point, don't even name it as imposter syndrome anymore. Name it as, yeah, I just walked into a new job. I'm learning new systems, new acronyms, new history on top of my job. Of course, I feel off base. And you just rename it and give myself permission to feel off base for the first 3 weeks, 3 months, depending on how big of a job and big of a change it is.
So you talk about talking yourself off the ledge. Is that what you're talking about? Kind of applying a rubric of logic to the whole thing that you can get rid of the irrationality through?
Yeah, well, I think it's again, it goes back to reframing, to kind of hit the pause button. So you're in this meeting, you have people who are more senior than you, for example, or you're going into a job interview, or like, what's that moment where you're most likely to feel like an imposter? And then take a moment and kind of become consciously aware of like, what is the conversation going on in my head right now? And how would somebody who is humble, but doesn't feel like an imposter, I call them a humble realist, mm-hmm. What would they be thinking in this exact same situation? They will be thinking, well, of course, this is intimidating. I'm with people who have control over my job. So yeah, I'm going to feel a little off base in this meeting with all these senior VPs, right? And I'm new in the company, or I'm 4 levels lower. And to normalize that, you know, or, you know, people sometimes walk into a new situation and they're like, oh my God, everyone here is brilliant. Meaning, and I'm not. I'd rather they say, wow, what a lot of smart people. I'm really going to learn a lot. Or I don't know how to do this. I've never done it before, but I can figure it out. Or, well, John, he has a podcast. I'll ask John how to do a podcast, you know, and to not think that you're lacking because you don't know something, but how can you figure it out?
I've worked a lot of places over the years, and I've been in a lot of situations. And once in a while, and I'm not going to name any names or locations, once in a while, I've run across people who really are in over their heads, who really don't know what they're doing. Are those people likely to have imposter syndrome, or are they likely to just not be the ones who ever get it?
You know, that's so hard to say, because some people are, you know, kind of set up to fail in a way, right? Put in positions where they, you know, they just don't have the experience, or they're, you know, you're 21 years old and you've now been made the manager of a bunch of 50-year-old guys, who engineers right. who've been there forever, right? So that's kind of a recipe for yikes. Somebody who is truly like that narcissistic person who has kind of irrational self-confidence syndrome, whose belief in their knowledge and skills far exceeds their actual knowledge and skills, they probably do not have imposter syndrome. They don't understand that they really don't know what the hell they're doing, but they think they are. And I think that's the most dangerous person.
How do you evaluate, like, in a logical, rational way, whether you might actually be in a situation where you can't succeed? I mean, as you talk about reframing it, but a lot of the reframing is a reassurance kind of thing of, no, I'm actually fine. I do belong here. I am smart. How can you apply that to, oh God, what if I am in the wrong place?
Yeah. I mean, I think give yourself some room to grow into something, right? Because you, again, especially if it's a whole new situation or huge project, you're not going to know everything in the beginning, right? You are going to have to be learning seat of your pants. You are going to have to be putting in extra hours and working really, really hard to kind of get up to speed. But that's different than believing I don't have within me the capacity to achieve the majority of the goals that I set for myself in life. I'd love to give you a quick example. And this actually was an example that came up in my doctoral research. I interviewed a woman who is senior in HR at a big insurance company in Hartford. And she told me this story I never forgot. There was a woman who was put in charge of what was then called data processing. You know, now it would be called IT. As you can imagine, the 80s, this was like a huge, unprecedented promotion for a woman to head up IT, essentially. Her first assignment was to set up a new facility a couple of hours away from Hartford. She's getting up at 3. She's getting home at midnight. She's burning out, but she's not going to ask for help. Social context is, I'm sure she felt the weight of the world on her to prove that she could do it. But I think she probably also had this mindset of imposter thinking, which is, I have to figure it out all by myself. She had what, you know, back in the day would have called a nervous breakdown. You know, physically, she couldn't go on. She took a leave of absence. They replaced her with this man. This man took one look at this job. He said, this job will kill somebody. You know, I want an apartment in the other city. I'll stay there during the week. I need 4 more staff members. I need complete access to all the division heads and home office. And I want more money. Right. And they said, sure. I don't think he got what he wanted because he was a man. I mean, some of that was in the mix, but I think there's a larger lesson here is that he understood that competence isn't knowing how to do everything yourself or perfectly or easily. Competence is knowing how to identify the resources it takes to get the job done. Time, money, budget, authority, training, right? So what do I need to achieve this goal and what am I not getting in this job right now that I need to go and ask for and say, if you want this deliverable by this date, here's what's required.
Imposter ER or imposter OR? What's your stance?
The eternal debate. In my book, I used OR because that's what Clance and I'm used. Okay. You know, I think the New York Times uses one differently than the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune. They're both, and according to the dictionary, which is just so bizarre, either one is accurate. ER is more searched on the internet than OR, but they're both correct.
Okay. All right. No need to create a divide or psychological anxiety around that spelling.
No.
Dr. Valerie Young, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed being here.
Just ahead, Dr. Ken Duckworth from the National Alliance on Mental Illness will talk about imposter syndrome in the context of mental health, mental disorders, and what might be behind this feeling that you're a massive fraud who will soon be exposed as the fraud that you are. As we go to break, we asked our listeners about your experiences with imposter syndrome. Here's one of the answers.
Hi, this is Kelsey from Detroit, Michigan. I gotta say, I am an artist, so imposter syndrome seems to happen pretty often. I think the most important thing about imposter syndrome is to remember that when you feel like you are somewhere and you're like, oh my god, I tricked everybody into being here, for me to be here, and I don't belong with them. It's a little easier to not believe that when you actually get to know those people a little bit better, because am I going to say that about my friends, my mentors, my teachers? I might say that about a bunch of group strangers, but I'm not going to say that about them because they believe in me for some reason. And I believe them because, you know, I like them. So, yeah, I think that's always important to remember is believe in everybody else who believes in you.
If you want to start a business and make your product or service available to everyone around the world, well, you can do that because internet and websites, I bet you've heard of websites. The internet is full of websites. How am I going to build a website, though, you think? I'm not a dang web designer. I'm not a dang web developer. I'm no dang webmaster. Well, good news, I'm here to tell you that you are a dang all those things. You can build a website, an e-commerce store, a web presence, and it's not that hard thanks to Squarespace. I did it, so therefore you can do it too. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. They have this new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, where you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. You can accept credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay. You can upload video content, organize your video library, showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even add a paywall and sell access to your video library. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
I'm Yucky Jessica.
I'm Chuck Crudsworth.
And this is Terrible,
a podcast where we talk about things we hate that are awful.
Today we're discussing Wonderful, a podcast on the Maximum Fun Network.
Hosts Rachel and Griffin McElroy, a real-life married couple.
Yuck!
Discuss a wide range of topics. Music, video games, poetry, snacks.
But I hate all that stuff.
I know you do, Yucky Jessica.
It comes out every Wednesday, the worst day of the week, wherever you download your podcasts.
For our next topic, we're talking Fiona, the baby hippo from the Cincinnati Zoo.
I hate this little hippo.
Dr. Ken Duckworth is the Chief Medical Officer for the National Alliance on Mental Illness and the author of You Are Not Alone, the NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health with advice from experts and wisdom from real people and families. Dr. Ken Duckworth, welcome back to Depression Mode.
Hey, John. It's so nice to be with you again.
Nice to be with you. Okay, so imposter syndrome is sort of based on, am I a real achiever in this arena or am I not real? Is imposter syndrome real, or is the syndrome itself the real imposter all along?
Well, let's put it this way. It doesn't exist in the diagnostic and statistical manual like some of the classic conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder or bipolar disorder or generalized anxiety disorder. So those are phenomena that people have observed, a series of symptoms that are reproducible. A psychologist in Ann Arbor, you know, and a social worker on Cape Cod would interview people and come up with the same set of symptoms to describe a condition. That doesn't mean we understand the underlying biology. It just means that these constructs are reliable so that you can say, okay, here's what this is, so that you can research it, try to make sense of it, try to write best-selling books about it, that sort of thing. So those are kind of the principles. So imposter syndrome doesn't exist as one of those phenomena. But I have heard people bandy it about over time. Could I be an imposter? You know, do I really deserve the accolades that I have created for myself?
Will I be exposed as the fraud that I am and paraded through the public square?
Right. Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because I want to emphasize there are a few people that are actually imposters, and you are probably not one of them. So periodically, you have the president of a university who's found that his research was, inappropriately doctored or, you know, a physician who's practicing medicine, who never went to medical school. There are actually imposters. So I want to emphasize that you in the audience, if you're not fabricating your research or making up a degree, are not the true meaning of an imposter.
Here's what I trip up on.
Yeah.
It seems like this feeling that, hey, I'm a fake, I'm a fraud, you know, somebody took a gamble on me and it really didn't pay off. I don't belong here. I shouldn't have this title affixed to my name. That seems to me like that can create behavior consistent with a disorder. It can make somebody dread going to work, therefore not show up for work. Mm. It can have an effect on their health. It could be disruptive to the routine of their life and the best functioning that they can have in their life, which is what I understand a disorder to be.
So if you were to say, you know, this is a distortion of thinking, not based in reality, but in fact is an automatic negative thought. I don't deserve to be here. I don't belong in this elite club. That's a cognitive behavior therapy problem. That is to say, to understand how your thoughts are impacting your experience and behavior. So to me, these are good psychotherapy questions. Let me give you an example. And some of this, I think, is a choice. John, I go out to dinner with four psychiatrists once a month. Uh-huh. They are all smarter than I am. They all went to more prestigious schools than I do. I arrive one evening a few minutes late, and they're discussing whether negative numbers really exist. No topic could be of less interest to me. I've never given this a thought. And in fact, I only went to one of the medical schools that did not require calculus. Not an area of strength of mine.
Right?
But I do pay my 1/5 of the bill. So I'm able to do enough math to participate and enjoy my friends. And some of it's a choice. I could choose to say I am, in fact, objectively dumber. That means if I'm not careful about my cognition, maybe I don't deserve to be a doctor. Maybe I don't belong with these guys. Maybe I'm the worst doctor ever. I don't have a big job at a fancy Harvard hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you could travel down a road. Another choice is to say, geez, these guys are geeks. Really into negative numbers. What's up with that? When's the last time that ever helped a person that you're taking care of? So that's a cognition, right? I could go down a road of I don't have the math skills that these lads have, which I don't. Or I could go down the skills. Gee, I guess there's a lot of different kinds of psychiatrists, right? Like that's a cognitive choice. So I don't choose to go imposter. I do notice it. I do notice the fact that they have a skill set or a dimension that I can't imagine. But some might say I'm as much fun or more fun than they are. So we're all differently abled, right, in some ways. So I would say to people, if you feel like you're an imposter, that's an opportunity to look critically at your thinking about yourself. And if you have chronic anxiety, you're worried that you really didn't do well enough on the exam, or you really don't belong to have gotten into the prestigious university program, job, or relationship that you're in, I would encourage you to look at your thoughts, because based on the outcomes in the world, you are at that job, at that university, in that happy relationship. So to me, this could become a psychotherapy challenge. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a book like Feeling Good by David Burns, which is kind of the everyman's CBT manual. Mm-hmm. Examine your automatic negative thoughts. What are the evidence that I'm really an imposter? Well, I went to a scruffy high school. I didn't really take a PSAT prep class. Yeah, but you got into the University of Michigan anyway, my alma mater. Yeah, well, you know, maybe I don't really deserve it. My grandfather went there. Okay, duly noted. You know, like, okay, that's a possibility, but somehow some objective person did admit you, right, to mm-hmm. this construct. And what do you know? I'm doing pretty well there, right? And so objectively, it'd be hard to make a case that you are, in fact, an imposter. And when you read about people who get kicked out of their prestigious jobs because they faked everything, read mm-hmm. those stories, because they're not you. You are struggling with this cognitive problem of, am I really capable of being where I'm at? And I would encourage you to consider celebrating where you're at.
It's good advice. If you have these cognitive distortions that lead to something like this, that lead to this thinking pattern that is that doesn't jibe with kind of a logical, rational reality, is that a sign that you have or probably have an anxiety disorder, a depressive disorder, like a thing that has a name? Like even if imposter syndrome isn't in the DSM, is it a sign that you have something that is?
Well, it could be a question to ask. People with trauma histories, people are told they're no good their whole life, right? By abusive parents or parents who have, you know, big vulnerabilities on the mental health side and did not attend to them. Mm. You're no good. You can't accomplish anything. I don't believe in you. You're no good. You know, that kind of thing. That's one way to get to a person who's like, Jesus, am I really okay? How did I get to this good school? So I think there's a lot of possible pathways, and it could correlate with mental health challenges. Like if you're so overwhelmed by this and you can't work, you can't go to school, you can't function in a relationship, it'd be probably a good idea to get a therapist.
Yeah.
But the interesting, this is different than the traditional definition of a mental health vulnerability, where you're functioning poorly. I can't go to work. I can't maintain relationships. I can't be with my kids on the weekends. I'm just too overwhelmed. So this is interesting because people are functioning higher than they think they might be able to do. It does represent an interesting challenge, John.
Yeah. So then is it something that can be overcome with just recognizing the rational reality? Or is it something that you really are better off going to a therapist? Like if someone's listening to this and saying, okay, I understand all the data is in that I do belong in this job, in this relationship.
And I didn't fabricate my research.
And I didn't
pretend to be a physician. Right? I mean, like, seriously, there are actual imposters and you're not one of them.
Right.
So you're asking the question. So I was never taught about imposter syndrome. I would consider this a kind of bread and butter psychotherapy challenge.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you understand yourself vis-a-vis how you're doing, right? And I would say many therapists would take this on very happily and say, oh, we can work with this. And typically what you do in cognitive behavior work is you assemble the things that are true. Well, I didn't prepare for the PSAT, and I, you know, didn't really do well in school, but I smoked the SAT back when they took them. And, you know, I did write a great essay, and the University of Michigan took me. Maybe I squeaked in. So one interpretation of this is that aren't I lucky? Another possible interpretation would be, oh God, I'm going to get smoked because I'm the dumbest kid in the class. Another possibility is I don't really belong here. But I encourage people to stay with the possibility. I seem to have pulled this off. Let's keep it going. Right? Like that's kind of where I think you'd like to get to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I always say somewhat in jest, but not entirely in jest, if they haven't caught me by now, it's not
right.
likely they're ever going to catch up with me.
And they are not that good.
Right.
Let's right. face facts.
Yeah. They've got a lot on their plate. They're not checking up on.
They've got a lot on their plate hunting down you, overachieving vis-a-vis your sense of what you're capable of. It's probably not on their problem list.
Is this something that can be addressed if people are going through this and if people are suffering? You know, it's even if it's not in the DSM, you don't want people to be suffering when they needn't be. Is it something that they can tackle on their own with just rational thinking and just sort of some of these reminders that
I think
we're
a lot of
them?
People can do this. This would be that variation on if you can't accept compliments because you don't feel that you deserve them, yeah. right? You know, really take it in. That's a nice haircut, John. Thank you, Ken. That's it. That's the whole thing. No, it's not a good haircut. I got on sale. You know, the guy runs it there. John, you look nice today. You have a nice haircut, right? Thank you. So this is the same idea. You have to kind of correct your thinking. Person's giving me a compliment. Accept compliment. Don't argue with them. Person's saying, isn't it cool you got into the University of Michigan? Shamelessly my alma mater, so this is why I'm bringing this up.
Right.
Isn't it amazing that you got into the University of Michigan? Well, I'm a little surprised, frankly, that I got in, but I seem to be stumbling along and I'm going to graduate in 2 years. right? So there's like how you approach it cognitively. So I want to emphasize, I was never taught one thing about imposter syndrome, but I have been taught a lot about how people organize their thinking to understand the narrative of their life. And how I would interpret this is that your success is greater than the narrative that you had allowed for yourself, right? Nobody expected that I would be, you know, a best-selling author, for example, or running a fabulous podcast in your case, or being in the honors program at the University of, how could that have happened? I didn't expect that for myself. So I think it's an interesting problem, but I think most therapists, I'm going to say a vast majority of therapists, would be happy to help people with this. If something like feeling good, like looking at cognitive behavior therapy or the Beck Institute, Judith Beck has written a number of books about how your feelings follow your thoughts. The basic principle of CBT is if you have automatic negative thoughts, I'm the worst guest John has ever had on this podcast. I'm the dumbest of the psychiatrists when we go out to dinner. I don't even know what negative numbers are, much less having a debate about them. This is a very spirited debate. You could choose to
sounds
think.
Like a great dinner.
Oh, my God. Well, as soon as I go, I rain on the whole party. What do you think of the Patriots? And like, that's a language they kind of speak. But, you know, we're different. And the point is, you know, they're different than I am. But I could have chosen to, you know, go into a very dark place. And the idea is not everything you do is going to be great. Not everything is going to be a success. Some ideas will fail. That's a more common cognitive behavioral construct. I've lost two relationships and I was fired from a job. I must be a terrible human being. I'm not worthy of anything. I think maybe I should end this. People go on to fairly dark automatic thoughts. It kind of spirals down a hill. The idea of CBT is to say, wait a second, you lost a relationship. Well, you lost a job. You lost another relationship. That sounds a lot like life to me. This is what the clinician would say, right? And let's talk about some successes. Well, I'm a fabulous dad, and I coach the local softball team, and I run Dungeons and Dragons for my oldest kid, and they think I'm the cool dad. Again, the idea is you assemble what's positive, right? In addition to dealing with your failures. And the idea is you come to a relatively balanced sense of self where, all right, I'm kind of a mixed bag. I got into the University of Michigan. Maybe I squeaked in. Turns out, you know, I'm hanging right in there. I'm probably going to graduate, right? They're not going to name any awards after me, nor am I going to win any. But I did get in, and maybe I got in because I'm from a geographically remote area, or maybe because somebody, you know, liked my essay. Like, it's kind of unknowable. It's a little opaque. So I encourage people not to spend a lot of time thinking that they're not worthy of what they've accomplished. Because life is full of heartache, too. And there will be times when you're not accomplishing what you want. Again, this is my perspective, having never attended a lecture on imposter syndrome.
You wrote this book, You Are Not Alone. It's done really well. A lot of people are reading it. A lot of people are really excited about it. First book you've ever written. When you had the success with it, did you ever have a thought of, oh, geez, I'm in foreign waters here. I'm in over my head with this book stuff.
Well, that's a great question. So, you know, when you're a first-time author, you know, I think I experienced more as a dream come true. And I couldn't have done it without assembling a whole group of people that I continuously thank and celebrate, right? So to me, I'm not sure I could have done it on my own. I wasn't trained as a writer. I'm just a plain old psychiatrist. But I had a cool idea, and I did know it was a cool idea, that real people would share what they had learned. And, you know, families like my own, you know, with a dad who was loving but very sick, could maybe get inspiration from each other. So at the end of the day, I did have a moment of thinking, oh, my gosh, who am I kidding? And then I'm like, oh, my God, I have a deadline. Let's get to work. And then by the time the book is out, well, I did actually write it. I mean, you know, I didn't fake write it. Right. No, I think I would have more imposter stuff if I had a ghostwriter that I didn't acknowledge. I had people who helped me, and I thank them at all time. I think that of more as a role transition. Like, you know, that's a different gear. But I don't think it's an imposter phenomena to say that I don't have any intention of writing another. I just had one good idea. So I don't have it switched my identity to now I'm really a writer. But it's a good question because I think when you travel in waters that you haven't swam in, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, is this going to work? And I do want to emphasize that I went to the How to Write a Book for Doctors class at Harvard 4 years in a row.
Oh, nice.
And literally, I said, first year, I thought, there's no way I could do this. Second year, I thought, I doubt I could do this. Third year, I thought, this ain't going to work. And then I'd watch these other doctors give talks about their successful books on zits or how to eat avocados. And I'm like, wait a minute, mental health's more important than that. But it took the cognitive realization that there was nothing different about me. Right. I didn't have to know negative numbers to write a book listening to real people. But I guess one way that I know I'm not an imposter is I had to work on this idea for a decade before I pulled it off. So, you know, when you put in that kind of effort, I think it might help. It wasn't a flash in the pan idea. I didn't become famous overnight. I'd be interested to talk to people who've had, you know, experiences that are different. But I think a lot of it is paying attention to how you think about yourself. And working to integrate your success into your life narrative. Even if you were told as a child that you couldn't do things, or if you exceeded your expectations.
The book is You Are Not Alone, the NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health, with advice from experts and wisdom from real people and families. Full disclosure, I'm one of the said real people that is mentioned in this book. Dr. Ken Duckworth, thank you as always.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
Here's another imposter syndrome clip from one of our non-imposter listeners.
My name is Christina Santiago, and I feel imposter syndrome about being a poet, even though I write poetry and perform poetry, and even published a book of poetry. Whenever I feel that sense of self-doubt, I go to my other poetry friends and they remind me, if it is fact, if it is true that you did a thing, then you did that thing. So whenever I doubt myself, I go back and say, is this real? If it is, then I am not faking it. It's legit. I'm legit. I'm not an imposter.
Laura House with a meditation moment after the break.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
And it's time once again for a meditation moment with our friend Laura House from the Tiny Victories podcast. Hi, Laura.
Hi, John.
And we're clear that meditation doesn't have to involve like saffron robes and multiple candles and gongs. It doesn't need to be a mystical experience.
Yeah, that's been my experience with it. Is I feel like people can be off-put by it or feel like they're not doing it right because it doesn't feel like an acid trip. But I if I can say anything to anyone, is it's just rest. It's taking time from it's interrupting your schedule of your brain screaming expletives at you to go, oh, that's right. I can just feel calm. I can just drop down and notice my breath and let everything go. And it's no more magical than, you know, when your kindergarten teacher makes you take a nap at school. Did you do that? Now it seems weird, but we did that, I think.
I think kindergarten or preschool. I remember at least some time where we would put our heads down on our desks and they would turn the lights out for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like that might be weird, but I think we did it.
I think we were meditating.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we had a little mat at the back.
Just
so
didn't realize. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want people to not be afraid of it or feel like it's some, you know, next level human experience.
You don't need to have epiphanies while you do this.
Yeah, I'm not going to stop you from having them, but it's just regular. So it's this right. We'll do it now.
All right.
If you can be in a safe place where you can close your eyes, so be at home or at least a parked car, sitting, head up, back supported, and close your eyes, just breathe. And you're already breathing, so you're already doing it, but essentially stop most other things. Just breathe how you're doing it. You don't have to change and make it an awesome breath. And you're going to have thoughts. And when you notice that you have thoughts, that's totally fine, but just notice your breath. You're just slightly internally putting some attention on your breath. And you can go ahead and open your eyes. But just some moments of letting everything go. It's healthy.
Yeah, I always find that when I open my eyes again, it's like, oh yeah, this is the same place I left, but now it's a calmer place. Now it's
it's like
more here than I was.
Exactly. It's like things kind of settle to the bottom a little, and you're like, oh, that's I didn't, and you don't notice that you have like a tornado of thoughts until you don't.
Right.
Like it just feels normal. Though this is just my normal tornado of thoughts that I'm in all the time. No big deal until you like notice something different.
And I didn't achieve complete enlightenment, and that's okay too.
Yeah, not maybe next time.
Maybe next time. Maybe not. Who knows? Laura House can be found on internet at laurahouse.com and also on the Tiny Victories podcast. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
On the next Depression Mode, imagine trying to take care of your own mental health while also playing King Lear 8 shows a week.
Your body doesn't know the difference between the imagined circumstance and the real circumstance. Now, you can pretend to do it, of course. You can put your hand over your face. You can do false sobs just as you can do a false laugh. But a real laugh or a real grief is going to take its toll. And there's always a time for me after I've played one of these parts of disentangling from that process. When we came out of Lear, for example, over the next month or 6 weeks, I realized that I needed a more conscious way of leaving that behind me.
Broadway and screen actor Patrick Page is with us. Depression Mode exists because of the donations of our listeners, because people have become members of the show. If you haven't become a member yet, that's okay. It's easy to do. You just go to MaximumFun.org/join. That's MaximumFun.org/join. Find a level that works for you and select Depression Mode from the list of shows. If you've already done this, we thank you because now we can exist. If you want to check out some cool merchandise, we've got t-shirts, we've got mugs, we've got sweatpants all at our merchandise store. And that is at MaxFunStore.com. MaxFunStore.com. You can check it out. We've got a lot of I'm glad you're here merchandise there. And I'm glad that the merchandise is there. I'm glad that you'll be there to go look at the merchandise. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. All of that helps get the show out into the world where it can help people. Speaking of helping people, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States 24/7 for free by calling 988. Three simple digits, 988. The crisis text line, also free and always available. Text the word HOME to 741741. Our Instagram is DepreshPod. So is our Twitter, DepreshPod. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. A lot of good conversation happening over there, people helping each other out. Our Depression Mode newsletter is on Substack. You can search that up. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at John Moe. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Hi, credits listeners. I'm back from vacation, and we went on vacation to Quebec, which is a lot like going to France, except you can drive there, and you can see whales in a fjord. We went to a fjord and saw whales, including mother and baby beluga whales. It was cool. Quebec. Depression Mode is made possible by your contributions. The show is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our production intern is and has been Clara Flesher, and she took the lead in putting this episode together as the finale to her internship. Thank you, Clara. We will miss you. Good work. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, I'm Christian from Los Angeles, and we're getting better every day.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.